I might just report at the outset that there are two living Naval Academy classmates that you might want to talk to get sort of their slant on the Naval Academy life together. My first year, I roomed with a friend from prep school named Skipper Dean, who became a naval aviator and was killed later, flat-hatting his girlfriend's house. So he's not available. And then in the second year, there was a reorganization of companies, and I ended up in initially a five-man room. One of the gentlemen flunked out, and I believe has now passed away. The others were a fellow named Logan, L-O-G-A-N. I believe he's also passed away. I'm not positive. Your two living classmates could confirm that. And they are Captain George Whistler, spelled W-H-I-S-L-E-R-N-O-T, and the Commander Ray Angelo, A-N-G-E-L-O, Raymond Angelo. Priscilla has both their addresses and telephone numbers.
She already sent them to me, sir, I think.
Oh, did she? Okay. So I'm giving you miscellaneous, unnecessary information. But that could give you some insights, I think.
Okay, she also sent me the name of your a friend of yours from high school.
Yes, sir.
In California.
Was that a Dale Hillman?
Yes, sir.
Right.
It was all in one short letter that I received about, I don't know, about a week after you left Lubbock for the conference.
And there are a couple of others from high school. There's a Don Hillman as well, who I was very close to and is still living there. And there's a John Sturgeon. I guess those are the ones who are closest still alive.
Okay, well, if you'd like, I'd like to begin by asking you what led you to apply to the Naval Academy as opposed to any other college or institution, given what your interests were when you were that age?
I had been a reader of Time magazine since the age of 12, and I was very conscious of the world scene developing, very much aware of Hitler's coming to power, and of the menace from both Mussolini and Hitler and the Japanese, and I felt very strongly that a war was coming. So both my dad and I, although I aspired to be a doctor and go into practice with my mother and father, believe that for me.
They have a fax coming up.
Okay.
They're bringing up the coffee.
Good. I think that's just a revision of my speech, but that's fine. We're convinced, and my dad agreed, that what I should aspire to first is a military career to get ready for the war. So we had in mind going to West Point, and had talked to our two senators and congressmen about an appointment, and learned from all of them that it was a competitive situation. You had to compete to get an appointment. And at the last minute, about a month before I was scheduled to take the competitive exam, a wonderful Irishman, a very wealthy fellow who was a sort of a political benefactor of the family and whom we had contacted about writing letters of support, came to see me. He had been born and grew up in New England and had a relationship with some of the old whaling families. And he talked at great length about the adventure of going to sea and how much more thrilling those experiences were than ground war. And it sounded so great to a young high school senior that I decided at the last minute to shift and compete for the Naval Academy instead. I actually, by that time, was in prep school following the graduation, because all the appointments were full at the time I graduated from high school, and so I went to prep school to cram for the competitive exams. And won an appointment from Senator Hiram Johnson for the Naval Academy to rid of that last-minute switch.
The old progressive.
That's right. That's right. Who was a very close friend of my great uncle Cicero Zumwalt, and he had written a letter expressing deep regret that he couldn't just arbitrarily give the appointment, but had to do it by competitive exam.
Had you had any interest in the military in general, or in the Navy in particular, at all before that experience?
Well, I was interested in the military because I felt we were headed for war, and I wanted to be ready for it. But the thought of joining the Navy was just as remote as that last-minute exposition from Mr. P.M. Longan, the wealthy Irishman. Mm-hmm.
If you could describe your Annapolis experience, you described it in On Watch as being a little more than a trade school. I'd be interested in your experience, what you thought when you arrived there, and how your time there progressed.
Yeah, I had never been away from home for any length of time at all, and had never been out of California until I left to go to the Naval Academy. When I arrived there, I was somewhat homesick, and also was very, very much aware of the fact that all of my good buddies were going on to colleges in California, and I was feeling sorrier and sorrier for myself that I wasn't going to be with them. And the stories that we heard is we were in Annapolis for, I guess, a week before we were to be sworn in, and the stories that you heard from the guys about what it was going to be like were such that I began to have second thoughts, and I called my dad, to whom I was very close. My mother at that time was terminal with cancer, so I didn't want to bother her, and I said to him that I didn't like it here, and that I'd like to come home. And He responded, okay, I'd come home, but as I said in the book, I think the tears in his voice kept me there, and I decided that for his sake I'd go ahead and go through with it, which was, you know, within a week I was very glad I had done that. I was having those last minute gnawing pains on my ass when you shift. Plebe year harassment, to me, was...
Excuse me, sir.
Is that mere stage?
Plebe year, for me, was kind of fun. A lot of people deeply resented or had psychological problems with the hazing, but I enjoyed it and didn't ever take it very seriously, and was sort of a rebel in the sense that I took some pleasure in bugging the upperclassmen, not remembering to do the things that they told me to do and that sort of thing.
What sort of hazing was there?
Well, for example, at the table, if you answered a question wrong, they would have you sit on air. You just push your chair back and sit as though you were on a chair until you fell back on your haunches. And if you fell too soon, they'd have you come around to whap you on the fanny 43 times for your class number, or do 43 push-ups for your class number. And I remember the one upperclassman was always bugged if the fork was turned out, and so I would always turn my fork out, knife turned out away from the plate instead of blade toward the plate. And I'd always do it the wrong way just to infuriate him. they would hit you with a broom for the whooping, which didn't really hurt a heck of a lot. And the push-ups, that was about the size of it. It wasn't brutal.
Were these like the questions that the cadets at West Point get, where there's a memorized answer?
That's right.
To a series of...
That's right. How low are you, Mr., lower than a bucket or whale shit at the bottom of so many fathoms of water.
I think the famous question from West Point is, how is the cow?
Yeah, that's right. That's another one that we get asked too, and I've forgotten now the long ritual answer.
So your father was pleased that you were going to Annapolis.
That's right, and he lived to see me sworn in to CNO and came to the ceremony, and I reported that story in my remarks to the crowd, the story of having called my dad and saying I wanted to come home, and the tears in his voice kept me there. So plebe year was fun, and I did what they call starred. If you get marks above a 3.4, you're called a star, and you wear stars on your uniform for that. Although there were a lot of people, I would say maybe a third of the class that had come in from college, and I had just come in from high school with a little subsequent prep schooling, I didn't have any trouble competing. Our Naval Academy course was changed because Pearl Harbor occurred on 7 December of 1941, and we then were changed from a four-year course to a three-year course. Within a week or 10 days, it was announced that the class ahead of us would graduate immediately in December, and that we would then be speeded up to graduate in June of 42 instead of June of 43. So what helped to make it seem more like a trade school was that they left out some of the more exotic subjects and just concentrated on seamanship and navigation and the things that you would, and engineering things you would need to use at sea.
So they shortened the course by subtracting the academic type subjects that you would normally have in college.
That's right.
Okay. And that I suppose was naturally a disappointment.
Yeah, but understandable because of the fact that we had to get out there.
Other than that, what is your opinion of the education that you got there, other than the fact that they had to speed your course?
I think that you had the opportunity to round yourself out. For example, I competed in the annual oratorical contest and won it the 2 years that I competed, won a gold watch. I was a member of the Quarterdeck Society, which debated, and the Trident Society, which wrote articles for the Trident magazine. So I had a chance to kind of develop speaking skills and writing skills on my own, and that was educational. But you had to do those extracurricular things to get what I would call a truly rounded educational experience, again, because of the foreshortening.
Mm-hmm. Did they require you to compete in athletic events?
Yes. Everybody must go out for something. If you're not good enough for varsity sports, you play battalion sports with competition between battalions and that sort of thing. I was a varsity football player in high school and went out for varsity football my plebe year and ended up with a football knee in about the first 3 weeks with two All-Americans hitting me from opposite sides. So I was out of varsity football, but I played intramural sports.
Mm-hmm. What was the thing that you liked the most about the Naval Academy while you were there?
I liked the discipline, and I liked the competition. You were ranked by numbers from 1 through 692. I was the lowest ranking midshipman the first year because plebe year they rank you alphabetically. So I came from the lowest ranking midshipman to where at the end of the year I was, I think, 48, and the end of my second year I think I was 16. And it was fun to, you know, see how high up the ladder you could place. And as I say, the discipline was, I enjoyed, and I was picked to be the senior three-striper, the regimental adjutant, which is about the, I guess, about the seventh senior leadership position in my senior year there.
So this ranking was based on everything they measure?
Yes.
Your academics?
All academics plus conduct and leadership marks.
Was there anything about the academy other than the shortening of your time there that you did not like?
No. I kind of thrived on it. The really heartbreaking thing that happened to me was that my mother had made me promise that I would not come home, because she wanted me to remember her as I last saw her. And I went away in June of 39, and she died in September of 39. And because of that promise, I was not able to go home. And that was a source of deep pain and regret, but I honored her commitment.
Mm-hmm. What are your memories from the time that you went to the Naval Academy? I mean, obviously one of the things that pushes you to do this is the coming of war as you see it. When you were at the Academy, in that time immediately before the war, from the eye of a young midshipman, from the eye of someone who was receiving military training, what is your view of what is happening in the world on the eve of the war, and how did that strike you as a young man?
Well, prior to Pearl Harbor, I was among, I think, relatively few who was convinced that we were going to be in the war soon. So Pearl Harbor did not come to me as a strategic shock, but on the Sunday that it occurred, we'd all been out in town and that sort of thing, and only learned when we came back for an evening meal that the thing had happened. There were two shocking things about it. One, we knew that we didn't yet know who was killed, with the exception of Admiral Kidd, who had been on the battleship Arizona and who was so senior that the radio carried that right away. But we knew that there were people who had just graduated the previous year who we will have known that were killed. And it just so happened that I was looking at Isaac Kidd Jr., who was a class ahead of me. It was two classes ahead of us that would have been killed. The class immediately had, it was speeded up, were still there. And I was looking at Isaac Kidd when they said Rear Admiral Isaac Kidd was among those killed. And I just saw this look of absolute horror on his face. I don't know whether he had been told earlier or not. I would assume so, but I'll never forget that moment. And the realization that, you know, within a short time we were going to be in the thick of it, and that we'd taken a hell of a beating at Pearl Harbor. It had the juices flowing and made everybody angry and eager to get at them.
A lot of what you read about the United States in the late 30s and right on the eve of war is that there was a very serious division of opinion between people who were isolationist and who thought that whatever happens is none of our concern, and people who took a more broad view that the United States can't avoid the rest of the world. Did you have any position on that at the time?
Yes, I did. I was very strongly among the interventionist school. I was a strong supporter Franklin Roosevelt's efforts to maneuver us into helping the British survive with the Destroyers for Bases deal, and by providing escort services, which was an act of war that the Germans chose not to not to resent because they didn't want us to come in, but we were actually patrolling part of the Atlantic for the British, and I was all for that. And I was watching with almost bated breath as Roosevelt managed to get the draft through by a single vote shortly before Pearl Harbor. And it was clear to me that the absolute horrible thing that Hitler and Mussolini and the Japanese were doing were the kinds of things that at some point the free world was going to have to get involved in and stop.
When you were commissioned out of Annapolis, I think one of the big deals or one of the big issues surrounding your career is the fact that later on it becomes more important that you're a service line officer. Was it apparent during your time through Annapolis that you were being trained to be a service officer, or how do they decide who's going to go into the submarines or into aviation or into the surface, and how did you end up being a surface
officer? It's a matter of individual choice. You all, in those days, you all had to go into the surface Navy originally, but then you were permitted to apply for submarine school or for flight training after you'd been at sea for a year or two. I originally thought that I would apply for flight training, and the reason I didn't was that by the time our class was eligible to apply, the war was at such a state that I figured if I went back for flight training, I would miss the rest of the action, and it was just such great professional experience that I thought I better not go at that time. By the time the war was over, I ended up as an exec of a destroyer, and then by that time I decided that I really did want to remain in the surface Navy, and although I could then have gone to flight training and been a little late getting in, it seemed to me that the surface Navy was the place to go, to stay.
Mm-hmm. Simply to get directly involved,
right,
with the war before?
Well, through the war, I deferred flight training, thinking I would go at the end of the war, and then by the end of the war, I had become an executive officer in Shanghai right after I was married, mm-hmm, and brought the ship back as an exec and saw the thrill of commanding and ship handling destroyers, and so I decided that I would instead make a career of the surface Navy.
When you were commissioned out of Annapolis, how much time was there between the completion of your education there and actually going to the Pacific? Was there additional training in between?
No, it went right out. I graduated on June 19th and went directly to San Francisco. As I recall, it was July 7th that I had to report in San Francisco, and that was... Thank you. I was assigned by the commandant of the 12th Naval District, along with about 70 classmates, to board the SS Calamaris, a merchant ship that had a Navy gun crew on board. But we were just put on as passengers to go to Pearl to catch our ships. At Pearl, we were put on a destroyer tender and then transferred to individual ships. Mine had already sailed. I was assigned to go to the destroyer USS Phelps, and it had already sailed for the Guadalcanal invasion, so I was one of a handful of my classmates put on board the troop transport Zeilin, Z-E-I-L-I-N, with a group of Marines that were going to be involved in landing on the island of Tulagi, which is right across the channel from Guadalcanal. And we overtook some of the ships. Some of our classmates were transferred to cruisers that joined up with us just before the invasion. We didn't catch up with my ship, so I was still on the transport Zeilin at the time of the invasion. And my battle station was to man a 20 millimeter gun on board this transport. the invasion occurred with relatively small loss initially, both on Guadalcanal and Tulagi. And then that night, there was a notice that a Japanese task force was en route. And the commanding officer of the Xilin then did one of the dumbest things I've ever seen done. Instead of sending the loaded boats with ammunition and supplies ashore to be with the Marines, he ordered us all into the boats to throw everything over the side so the boats could be retrieved and the ship get underway. All ships had orders to get out. But this fellow was still of the peacetime mentality that you had to save your own property at the expense of the Marines who were ashore fighting. And us ensigns just were furious about it. We couldn't understand it. And the next morning, a Marine warrant officer who had been left on board ship to supervise the offloading was up looking at bedrolls and flotsam and jetsam floating all around that had been thrown out of the boats. And he shook his head and said, anyone that makes a career of the Marines is a masochist. That same night, the Battle of Savo Island took place, and the four cruisers were sunk, Astoria, Quincennes, Canberra, and Quincy Vincennes, Astoria, and Canberra, the Australian cruiser. And classmates who had been transferred just a day or two before were killed on those ships. I gave you more information than you asked for.
No, sir. It's all useful. So during the actual battle itself, you were away from the action, or were you near enough to understand what was happening?
No. We were, as we looked at the fires, we saw these four huge explosions of fires. Everybody on our ship thought it was Japanese ships going down. We just couldn't believe that American ships could be taking that beating. And it was only the next two or three hours as the radio traffic began to come in that we realized it. In those days, information was not disseminated either particularly well. And after that battle, I was transferred to an oiler, which went out to fuel the destroyers that were the carriers. I was transferred from the oiler to the carrier Saratoga, and I was on board the carrier Saratoga to see the battle. The invasion of Guadalcanal took place on August 7th, as I recall. And I was still chasing my destroyer when I was on board the Saratoga during the battles of August 22nd and 23rd, where the Enterprise, which was in company with us a few thousand yards away, was hit, and another classmate was killed. And then, ultimately got to my destroyer when it came alongside the carrier to refuel, and it had been out on independent duty somewhere. The skipper and the commodore on board the Phelps got me up to report what I had seen, and they did not know at the time I was reporting to them about the sinking of the four cruisers. Although they did know about the battle of August 22nd and 23rd when the carriers, the Japanese and American carriers, exchanged strikes.
Mm-hmm. So what, when you actually get out to the war, Guadalcanal, Savo Island, what is your perception of how the effort is and how your view of the Japanese is?
At that point, we'd all thought, well, Pearl Harbor was just a breeze because the Japanese had in cowardly fashion attacked us without notice. And our view was that, you know, when it got to be man for man, that we would just skunk them. What we didn't know was just how badly prepared the U.S. Navy was. And Guadalcanal, the Battle of Savo Island, began to teach us how ill-prepared we were. Neither side had radar. The Japanese had perfected radio direction finding. in theory, all that gave you was a bearing. But the Japanese had trained themselves to make reasonably good estimates of distance as well by the strength of the signal. And they furthermore had selected people with unusually good night vision so that they were able both to pick us up ahead of time by RDF, know approximately how far away we were, and then see us through their better night vision before we were able to see them. Mm-hmm. And then of even more scandalous nature, our torpedoes were miserable and theirs were very good.
Long lengths?
So, yeah, they were longer range, much longer range, much more reliable. Ours were not as long range and much less reliable. And it was only after several fixes were made that our torpedoes began to perform reasonably. So it was about that time that we began the jocular, they say, Golden Gate in 48. This was 1942. And we thought it was going to be a long, long war. What we couldn't see was the tremendous production going on back in the United States, bringing thousands and thousands of aircraft and ships available to overwhelm them, but it was very thin pickings in those early days.
But you never had the view, I guess this is a view that would be more commonly associated with Vietnam, there was never a sense of frustration or lack of direction or never any doubt that you would eventually win once.
That's correct. I think we all knew we were going to win the war in the long run. We were really shocked to discover how ill-prepared we were in comparison to the Japanese. And I think from flight rank on down, the theory had been, well, they're just a bunch of little monkeys looking with their fannies, mm-hmm. And did not perceive how well-trained and how well-developed their equipment was.
And that had been your view initially as well, that these Japanese are all small buck, you can beat them easily?
Yes, I think, mm-hmm. We midshipmen were given that view by our officers, and I think everybody in the Navy felt that way.
Mm-hmm. So did you get more respect for them as the war went on? Or
yes, I did.
Because of the way they fought?
Beginning with Guadalcanal, I ended up having a very deep respect for them and felt like we had to be as well trained as we could be and as cunning as we could be if we were going to win.
Mm-hmm. When you arrived at the Phelps, what was your first position there?
I was made the assistant engineering officer and the electrical officer. I also was assigned to be a junior officer of the deck, watching three. And I immediately became seasick on the destroyer Phelps. I'd been on big ships up until that time. And I was seasick for about the first 3 months I was on board. I'd bring a bucket with me when I went up to stand watch. And my very first fitness report reads something like this, that Ensign Zumwalt may be a good officer, but we have not been able to get a good evaluation because he has been essentially seasick for the first 3 months on board, and it's therefore recommended that he be transferred to a bigger ship. And attached to that is my statement that I believe I'm getting better and that I would like not to be transferred and would like to stay on the ship. And I've always thought that, you know, when you go through a record for selection, you start at the bottom and look at the first fitness report and then go up to get to the more current. And I've always thought that very mediocre report showing that I insisted on staying there and sticking it out probably contributed as much as anything to getting promoted early, mm-hmm. later on.
So did you overcome the seasickness just simply by becoming used to the motion of the ship?
Yeah, finally after about 3 months I got used to it. And then for the rest of the war it was all right. Ever thereafter, when I first went to sea on the destroyer, I would be seasick until Dramamine came along. Once Dramamine came along in about the 1950 time frame, I never had any more problem with it. I'd take Dramamine for the first 2 days at sea, and then I'd be fine.
Mm-hmm. Got your sea legs? Or,
right.
Describe your experiences aboard the Phelps. What happened to the ship? Where did it go while you were aboard?
My best buddy, a fellow named Brian Pickett, and I were together all through that experience, including the Saratoga. But he stayed on the Saratoga. That was the ship to which he was assigned, and I went to the Phelps. And the Phelps was one of several destroyers escorting Saratoga. The Enterprise, having been hit, had gone back for repairs to Pearl Harbor. The Phelps continued to escort, and a few days after the battles of August 22nd and 23rd, the carrier air battles, the Saratoga was torpedoed. I was on the deck of the Phelps when the radio message came in from another destroyer that a torpedo had been sighted headed for the Saratoga. I knew that my buddy Brian Pickett was assigned to the 5-inch mount, and I knew which one he was assigned to, and I looked and I could see him standing beside the mount as this torpedo was headed for the Saratoga. When it hit and there was this flash of water, I saw him fall just from the force of the blow of the ship. I can remember that very vividly. The damage was sufficient that the decision was made that the Saratoga would have to go back to Pearl Harbor for repairs, and the Phelps was then designated to escort her. We went first to the island of Tonga Tabu, which was a very exotic South Pacific island. I couldn't find Dorothy L'Amour there, but the king of Tonga Tabu was a huge man who had a reception for us. He was about 7 feet tall and weighed about 350 pounds. And his family still rules this island, and all the successors have been huge people as well. We were there for 3 or 4 days and had a great time swimming and eating coconuts and so forth, and then back on the ship to escort the Saratoga back to Pearl Harbor. And then the Phelps was sent back to the States for repairs, for overhaul. She had been at sea for quite a while. And so I was then back in Mare Island for about 3 months. I remember by that time, those of us who were ensigns had saved about $1,800, which was about 6 months' pay in those days. And we all figured that we were going to die in this war anyway. So we figured we were going to be in port. We were going to have 30 liberties while we were there. So we divided $1,800 by 30 and decided we had to spend $60 a night, which in those days took a lot of spending because a drink was 10 or 15 cents. And so we would take a taxi to San Francisco and look for girls and have some drinks, and then take a taxi to across the Golden Gate Bridge to, or the San Francisco Bridge to Oakland, just to spend some more money by taxi, and then have a dinner, and then swing back. And if we hadn't spent our $60, we'd spend harder the next night because we didn't want to have anyone went back to sea. On that overhaul, we had radar installed, and I was sent, in those days, radar was so new that they didn't have operational courses. So what I was sent to, as the best thing skipper figured they could find, was to sit in on 3 weeks of a 9 month electronic maintenance course. So I learned something about the repair of electronic circuits, but didn't learn anything about the operational capabilities of a radar. I've managed to find some literature that described it in very general terms. We went to sea, and our first assignment was to go up to Seattle to meet up with some ships and then subsequently escort them up to the Aleutian Islands for the invasions of the island of Kiska and of Attu. And on the first night out of San Francisco, the skipper called me to the brig. I was not on watch at the time, but the radar was my assignment. I had been given the additional responsibilities as combat information officer and radar maintenance officer by that time.
Based on 3 weeks of instruction.
That's right. And there was on the PPI scope of the radar, there was a big kind of blob. And the skipper said, "What is that, Ensign?" And I remembered reading that sometimes the radar would pick up ionized layers, which would look sort of like a big mass on the scope. So I said, "Captain, that must be an ionized layer." And he said, "Fine." I went back down, and about an hour later, he called me up to the bridge, and there was a whole convoy of merchant ships, about 35 or 40 ships. And he said, "Take a look at your goddamn ionized layer." So by that time, we both realized that I hadn't had much operational training, but I learned fast. And we learned to distinguish masses of ships from ionized layers. We went from there up to Seattle, rendezvoused with our ships, and took off for the invasions of Kiska and Attu. I omitted a step. After we finished our overhaul in San Francisco and before we went up on that trip to Seattle and ultimately to the Aleutians, we had about 2 months operating in and out daily from Long Beach, where we just went out and did gunnery exercises and exercised with submarines and that sort of thing, but no night work, so we didn't really have a chance to practice on the radar. And then we took off for Seattle, and that's when this experience occurred. Shall I go on with the Aleutians?
Certainly.
In the Aleutians, our first assignment was to seize Attu, which was the westernmost of this long line of Aleutian islands. The Japanese had seized both Attu and the next one to the east, Kiska. And we had reinforced Dutch Harbor, which was still further east, and our ships were operating out of there. And it was deemed desirable to recapture first the westernmost island so that we'd have a base out of which we could attack the Japanese bases at Paramashiru, which was at the southern end of the Kamchatka Peninsula. Excuse me. And which at that time, the Japanese controlled all of those Kurile Islands. We did the invasion of that too, fairly well with very low casualties on the part of the U.S. forces, and all of the Japanese were annihilated, none of them surrendered. As I recall, there were no prisoners taken. On about the 15th or 16th day of that invasion, we were patrolling off the coast, and suddenly, across the island ridge, I was the officer of the deck, a group of aircraft came in, all abeam one of another. The lookout, who was expert training, said, "Those are B-25s. And then the next report was, "They've dropped their gas tanks." And the next report was, "Jesus Christ, the gas tanks are underway. Torpedoes, torpedoes." It turned out they were Betty's Mitsubishi 97s, flying out of Paramashiro, an extreme range. They attacked us and the gunboat Charleston, and I'll never forget three torpedoes streaming toward us. We As officer of the deck, I, of course, sounded battle stations, gave right hard rudder so we could try to parallel the torpedoes, and went up to flank speed. The skipper, who was a huge fat man, about 300 pounds, came to the bridge, saw that I had already put the enunciators all the way down. I'll never forget this. He was so eager to see the ship build up speed that, like a kid on a scooter, he kept his hands on the enunciators and was going like this to make it go faster, which is one of the many foolish things you do in action. The Japanese strafed us after they had dropped their torpedoes. Miraculously, they didn't hit anybody. The chief engineer had been lying in his bunk, and just as he got out of his bunk, machine gun bullets ripped through his mattress. A yeoman typing on a typewriter in the ship's office had the typewriter blow up in front of him, but nobody's hurt or wounded. The torpedoes passed under the ship and did not explode. The Japanese announced the next day that they had sunk a light cruiser, and our ship was of the destroyer leader class, and in silhouette it sort of looked like it was a light cruiser, and we figured the Japanese army ashore had probably identified us as a light cruiser, and the gunboat Charleston roughly had the silhouette of a battleship, although it was quite much smaller. And so they apparently had set the torpedoes too deep for both ships, and no torpedo hit. After the invasion of Attu was completed, we were sent back to Dutch Harbor to replenish, and then sent to go about 500 miles south of the Aleutians to escort ships up to the